Today, on the 40th anniversary of the Brixton riots, we look at what caused the unrest and ask whether similar frustrations are still simmering today.
So there's this really famous quote from Martin Luther King.
I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air. A riot is the language of the unheard.
And it really spoke to the time in the 50s and 60s where race riots were becoming a common thing in America, where a new generation of African Americans were becoming increasingly frustrated that the equality that was promised to them hadn't arrived. I think it's worth linking that to what we were seeing in 1981 in Brixton and then across the country, across England.
In spring 1981, anger erupted on the streets of London. The capital had not seen this level of violence for more than a century.
It was really interesting because I spoke to this community activist called Roz, and she says something quite similar. She describes Brixton as the epicenter for the black community.
And it was also the place for protests.
You know, she said to me, I know what something was going to happen, and it definitely did.
If I didn't know what a revolution looked like, that was it. Things had to change.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the Brixton riots, through the eyes of those who were there. Amna Modin, you're community affairs correspondent for The Guardian, and you've been working on a special series of articles to mark the anniversary of the Brixton riots. I know you've been talking to people who were there at the time, and we're going to be hearing from them throughout this episode. You weren't born then, were you? How much did you know about that period?
The reason why I wanted to do this series was because I knew of the Brixton riots of 1981, but I didn't realise how much it linked with previous grievances around police brutality, around mass youth unemployment, around, you know, really bad housing, and just a new generation of Black Britons, particularly feeling like though they were born and raised in this country, they just didn't belong.
And this was, of course, when Margaret Thatcher had just come into power. How did her policies start to shape race relations in the UK?
What we're beginning to see is something that we all quite understand now, is just how effective in elections and in politics, kind of stirring up anger, resentment and fear of new immigrant groups was then.
People are really rather afraid that this country might be rather swamped by people with a different culture. And you know, the British character has done so much for democracy, for law, and done so much throughout the world, that if there's any fear that it might be swamped, people are going to react and be rather hostile to those coming in.
And there was genuine anger and frustration and fear around increases in street crime. People aren't assimilating very well. Like I said, these are not new arguments to those of us who are involved in reporting politics now.
So if you want good race relations, you've got to allay people's fears on numbers. That's one thing that's driving some people to the National Front.
And there were some big National Front demonstrations in the UK during the late 70s. It must have been a pretty scary time for people of colour.
People I've spoken to said they would run. You know, they'd be really scared to find gangs of white men at the time. They felt like they were under attack by police officers and felt under attack at the lack of opportunities and the houses that they were living in. Just felt like quite a grim time, I would say, to be an ethnic minority, but particularly to be black in Britain.
And when it came to the police, there was huge controversy over the use of what was known as the sus law, which would allow officers to stop and search any suspect individual. There was huge frustration about that, wasn't there?
Yes, definitely. So that was one of the tools used by the police to crack down on street crime.
The police were stopping and searching people, black boys in particular, young men, for the suspicion, not that they're committing a crime, that they suspect that you're going to commit a crime.
Roz, who I spoke to, was a teenager growing up in Brixton at the time. And she said, you just had the male members of your family just being snatched constantly on the street and being stopped and searched, either your brother, your uncle, your dad, your son. And though this was largely happening to young black boys, young black men, it affected the whole community, it affected the whole family.
It was the women who would go down to the police station for their sons. So they weren't sitting at home doing knitting. Oh no, they went on the battlefield.
Women would go out to try to find missing male members of their family. They would go to police stations. They would go speak to other people to figure out what's happened to them.
Yes, they did not want to be burying their sons. They did not want to be going to the police station to find that their sons are in body bags.
Everyone knew somebody. I mean, I suffered from it myself. Everyone knew of a tale of a young black guy being hauled into the police cells and getting beaten up.
Alex Wheatle is now a 58-year-old British novelist. He's written a number of really successful novels, and he really draws from the experience of being a teenager who took part in the riots.
People were just frustrated, didn't know what to do, and no one listened to us, no one believed us, you know, so there was a massive frustration in our minds.
People just said they felt like they were under attack.
How were black communities starting to respond to that?
People were beginning to fight back. I think what's really important to know, before Brixton happened in 1981, in 1980 in Bristol, there was rioting there. I mean, it was on a much smaller scale, but there was huge, huge anger at policing tactics. And on the 2nd of April, police raided the Black and White Cafe at the heart of an area that loads of young black Bristolians hang out. That ended up being a spark for huge levels of unrest then.
Incredibly, it happened. In an English street, a bank was burnt out by rioters. The riot propelled St. Paul's Bristol into the headlines.
And do we know how that was playing out in the minds of people in Brixton?
I think people were definitely aware of it. There was really important activist networks that were telling people, you know, what was happening in their town. There were these black newspapers. So definitely people were really aware that this was a national issue.
And were the police particularly focused on Brixton?
Yeah. There was an area of London at the time, it was known as the L District, and this includes Brixton. There was huge, huge concerns about street crime. So in 1980, the first 7 weeks, there was a 78% increase in street crime compared with the previous year. They saw significant increases in robberies particularly. So it just really got flooded with police officers. I think in Brixton alone, there was about 240 police officers stationed there.
So by the start of 1981, there was a big police presence on the streets of Brixton, and the relationship between the force and black communities especially was getting more tense. Tell me what happened next.
In the run-up to April 1981, police decided to do this special exercise. It was known as Operation Swamp, and it consisted of like 100 police officers drawn from the local police stations, and their role was to patrol in plain clothes in chosen area between 2 p.m. to 11 p.m. every day. And when they were brought in again, huge increases in stops and search. I spoke to this guy called Julian. It was really interesting because he said he came down to London to study for his degree and ended up living in Brixton. And he described himself as quite a naive 24-year-old white man. He wasn't really aware of everything we've just talked about, what the relationship was like between the police and black people specifically.
I was on the way to college, I think. I went to Brixton Tube Station, and the tube station had been taken over by a group of young white men dressed in blue jeans and bomber jackets and baseball shoes, and they were generally harassing everybody in the station, grabbing people, pushing them around. And I'd never seen anything like it, so I thought it was, I don't know, a group of hooligans, as it were. Mm. And I went up to the ticket counter and said to the guy, shall I call the police? And he said, no, they aren't the police.
And what was fascinating was this wasn't just a moment of political transformation, of anger spilling on the street, you know, this awakening for the black community. It was true for the white people around as well.
Okay, so that's the context of the time. That's how it felt to be in Brixton in the spring of 1981. Tell me how the unrest began.
Everyone describes Friday the 10th of April as one of the first warm days of the year. People were out and about but there was a huge level of tension because Operation Swamp is happening. So we had a young police officer patrolling. He saw a really distressed young black man running towards him, and he could see that he was bleeding from a stab wound. So this police officer goes towards him and he says he tried to offer help, but the young man and the people around him kind of just assumed he was about to be arrested. And this bleeding young man ends up running away. He eventually does get medical care at a local hospital, but I think it's really notable that he didn't want support from the police, and the people around him didn't trust him at all. Then, you know, a crowd begins to form around this police officer and his colleagues, and that day they're hit with bricks and bottles. And that night, Brixton is basically alive with rumours. These rumours are false, but they say that the police stopped the young man from getting treatment and that he died.
All we heard was there's fire in Brixton, there's fighting. We also heard that the police were beating up, you know, killing black people. So the neighbourhood went out, you know, you had to go and find out what was going on.
The next day, Saturday on the 11th of April, as part of, again, Operation Swamp, two police officers stop and search a guy. I mean, you can speak to different people about what's happened because it's quite contested. But some of the local residents said, again, quite a needlessly intrusive stop and search. And another crowd begins to gather. There's huge levels of anger. And that's when we really start to see things kicking off by the afternoon of the 11th of April.
I just followed a crowd who just raced into Atlantic Road, and by the time I got there, there was rocking a police van from side to side, and it smashed onto the road.
A superintendent at the time just realised, okay, the situation was, quote, explosive, and he called out for senior police officers. Then we're beginning to see this kind of hour-long battle on Leeson Road and into Railton Road. Police officers really struggling to hold the line.
I was with a couple of friends drinking Guinness and looked out of the window and I saw this police car, which I think was a panda car, which was upside down in flames, and it was just sort of moving past the window as if it was being sort of, not thrown, but carried or something, just sort of floated past the window with a WPC distraught sort of running after it. So the landlord locked us in, and then there were a few people hammering on the doors to get in saying there was you know, trouble in the streets.
It's just absolutely extraordinary, really, what goes down in the next few hours. A double-decker bus driven by someone in the crowd towards the police line.
What we did when we had the chance to say, OK, enough is enough, we took it. I don't think the police saw it coming. I really didn't.
The Windsor pub begins to burn then, and we see some looting beginning.
Then there was a fight around the Windsor Castle pub. The first petrol bombs were thrown, the Windsor Castle was ransacked and then set alight.
The flares could be seen all over Railton and Mail Roads.
As I got into the area, you could see the fighting. It looked like war. I watched my community burn to the ground.
Fire brigade starts to come, and I think that's when you see Roz kind of coming out. Alex is out there now as well. I think Julian's stuck in that pub. And then we had Ross, who came down from Cambridge, I think it was, for his birthday. And he was in the cinema and remembers very clearly a man with a quite heavy accent coming in saying,
"You guys are wasting your time in here. It's happening for real outside. When we went out, it was happening.
Job, money, and National Front and all the rest. We've just had enough."
What you're seeing, like, near the evening of Saturday is just complete chaos.
To actually see the police retreat was something I'd never seen before. It's usually us running away from the police. They were the ones cowering, trying to pick up dust bottles, trying to defend themselves and so on.
Many people have been asking the question, what caused the trouble in Brixton Railroad today? I the only one answer. That the youth and the police need Jesus Christ.
It was just full-on battle. Blood was shed. But I could still hear reggae music. I don't know where it was coming from, but you could hear reggae music.
There was also community leaders getting in, desperately trying to de-escalate the situation. One of them, you know, was Reverend Nind. And he was kind of an in-between the crowd and the police line. And he kind of tried to negotiate some sort of truce. The commander at the time refused. He was really worried if he withdrew the police officers, that the violence would only get worse. And then it just kept escalating.
Alex Wheatle, who was a teenager living in Brixton and who had faced frustrating encounters with the police, found himself in the midst of the action that weekend.
After the 11th, I managed to get home to Elm Park in the early hours of the morning, something like 2-3 o'clock or something like that. I managed to get through the police cordon or whatever, because I was fighting on the front line. But I got arrested about 2-3 weeks later. Basically, they discharged down the door, the front door and my bedroom door, and arrested me. You know, there I was in my underwear.
Wow.
And, yeah, I hardly got a chance to put my clothes on.
You must have been really quite scared.
Yeah, it's very scary, because what went through my mind thought, oh Lord, you know, I'm going to the police cell and they're gonna beat the shit out of me. That's what happened. All you try and do is protect your privates and protect your face. You know, because in those days there were no recorded interviews. I don't think there were cameras in police cells or anything like that. So they got their own back.
In the end, hundreds of people, including police officers, were injured in the fighting and businesses were burnt to the ground. It's estimated that the cost of the clear-up was £7.5 million. The uprising in Brixton was just the beginning. That summer, there was unrest in Toxteth, Handsworth, Southall, Heyson Green and Moss Side.
The worst of the rioting came just after dawn, when police faced a hail of stones, bottles, iron bars and petrol bombs. The missiles were hurled from behind barricades of upturned and burning cars.
Tell me what the problems are.
Just the police and jobs.
The police had asked you too much.
You're watching out, there'll be loads of trouble.
The government began to realise that black people across the country were seriously unhappy with the way they were being treated by police and with the economic situation facing their communities. Ministers knew they had to respond.
What the government did was almost immediately commission an inquiry into the serious disorder that occurred in Brixton between the 10th and 12th of April and asked Lord Scarman to look into it and make recommendations.
What did Scarman find?
What was particularly interesting was that Scarman did not find evidence of institutional racism. He said the Metropolitan Police was not institutionally racist. That said, there were clearly issues in the way that the policing tactics were occurring in places like Brixton. He found significant evidence of disproportionate and indiscriminate use of stop and search powers by the police against black people. And the report also really sparked a conversation about the role of social deprivation and unemployment in bringing young people to protest violently on the streets.
Scarman makes it perfectly clear that that a lot of the fault and a lot of the blame for the riots lies in the social conditions in Brixton. What can the government do to improve those? What will the government do to improve those?
Well, of course, there are many factors, and one must say at once that unemployment, social conditions, racial disadvantage, all these are factors. None of them are, of course, an excuse for violence, and I think we've got to sit on that all the time. Nor are they an excuse for crime, and it is the police's main job to deal with crime in any area, and that they must do.
How did the government respond to the findings?
A new code for police behaviour was put forward in the Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984. You know, things like the sus law just weren't allowed to happen anymore. You had to have reasonable evidence to stop and search someone, to bring them into a police station. The act also created an independent police complaints authority, which was established in 1985. And I think this one is crucial because, speaking to Alex, he said, we knew this was happening, but no one believed us. You know, there was nowhere for them to turn to about this issue that they were having with the police. Now, finally, there is.
What effect did all of that have in Brixton and for the people you've interviewed?
Within Brixton, the Scarman report was welcomed, but obviously people felt like it didn't go anywhere near far enough. But I think politically, Brixton had a huge impact on both Roz's and Alex's generation. Alex, you know, like I said, he's a really successful author now. Do you put the experiences of what you saw during those nights as driving your like creative output, your writing, your novel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it informed me politically that everybody has a right to be in a story. I mean, this is Simeon, who was my cellmate. He always instilled in me that, Alex, your experiences are important. Mm. You know, even though I had a difficult time after I was sentenced, I had a difficult time gaining work when I came out of prison and so on. Those words stayed with me.
His life was depicted recently in Steve McQueen's Small Acts anthology.
That was an experience. to have my life depicted by someone like Steve McQueen was, wow, you know, I still kind of scratching my head about it.
And it goes to show the role that him and his generation has gone to play. And Roz also, you know, said that we found our voice.
It was the revolution generation. So I was influenced by Bob Marley when he said, until the philosophy which holds one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned, everywhere is war.
Amna, I know that a lot of people you spoke to don't like what happened being described as a riot. Why is that?
For them, it was an uprising. It was like what they felt was justified anger and frustration and abuse. So they describe it, you know, even the words that I use, right, like the front line and uprising, that's what it is for them. And I think something that was interesting for me was when we look at other moments in history where oppressed groups have risen up, like Stonewall, right? The Stonewall riots, that is seen as the beginning of the LGBT movement in the US and of course here in the UK as well. For people like Roz and Alex, they would like to see the similar framing for Brixton. You know, we know that there were significant levels of activism, political activism in the previous generations, the Windrush generation. With theirs, they want to see what happened in 1981 as the start of something really important.
Coming up, how much has really changed in the decades since Brixton? Amna, this was 40 years ago. And since then, we've of course had the McPherson report, which was a landmark moment in terms of police scrutiny after Stephen Lawrence was murdered in 1992. Unlike Scarman, it found that the Met Police was institutionally racist. From the conversations you've had, what do you think has changed in the relationship between the police and Britain's black communities?
A lot has changed. I think it's important to say that, you know, what Alex was describing and what Roz were describing as they were 15, 16, of people just being grabbed, manhandled, being beaten up in police stations, that doesn't happen much at all in 2021. And thank God for that. There are codes, police officers wear cameras, there are rules around stops and searches, but it's nowhere near enough. You know, we still have significant disparities in stop and search in areas like Brixton. And I think particularly with the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, we're seeing that same anger and frustration in the way that policing is done in the UK.
And that's the police, but this was about so much more. It was about economic disadvantage as well. It was about discrimination and a sense that black voices weren't being listened to. And yet here we are in 2021 and another report has come out playing down institutional racism. Now, I know the government has distanced itself a bit from that report, but as you told us last week, it handpicked the commissioners. What does that show us about how determined politicians are to see race through a particular prism?
It just shows that a lot of the lessons of 1981 are not being learned. It's not rocket science, right? Like these social conditions, if you uplift the people who are worst affected by it, it just ultimately helps everybody. It helps young black boys in Brixton, but also helps young white boys as well. So I think it's really depressing that a lot of the conversations that were being had, you know, again, just like scrolling through the Guardian archives, looking at the reporting, it's astonishing to me that what our social affairs editor was reporting on in 1981 is what our social affairs editor is reporting now. Was enough done after Scarman? And all you have to do is look at 1985, Brixton, there's another riot there. More rioting follows across England in 2001. And again, obviously, we've got the 2011 riots. So I think the fact that we've got this cycle, you know, it really touches on that Martin Luther King quote, unless the social condition for riotings are dealt with, are removed, they're just going to continue happening.
I mean, it's amazing how often things repeat themselves and how often lessons are not learned. I mean, you're talking here about Brixton 40 years ago. 20 years ago, we saw riots in Bradford and Oldham. And 10 years ago, we saw London riots that then spread across the country. Given the police response to recent protests and given how COVID has disproportionately hit minority communities, are the conditions rife for more unrest?
Definitely. And I think, you know, we've seen that with police warning the government that the same conditions that existed then exist now. I think it's really, really telling that you've got community activists and you've got academics telling policymakers, you know, you need to ensure any recovery from the coronavirus pandemic doesn't leave the young behind. And most importantly, you need to ensure that trusted community voices remain at the heart of British policing.
Amna Modin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Amna Modin, one of The Guardian's community affairs correspondents. Do go and read her brilliant reporting on all of this at theguardian.com. I'd also really encourage you to listen back to last week's Today in Focus with her if you missed it. It's called Why the Government's Race Report Sparked a Furious Backlash. And if you fancy a Today in Focus back catalogue binge, then we also loved making other episodes on important moments in Black history, including the story of the Mangrove Nine and the Bristol bus boycott. Do check them out. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Alex Mislin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.